This is God and the Brain, an Eden Project podcast where we explore discipleship to Jesus at the intersection of neurobiology, psychoanalysis, and attachment theory. I'm Karen.
And I'm Nathan. You guys enjoy this episode. Hey guys, I am back this week on God and the Brain with Dr. Jim Wilder. Jim, thanks for being back with us, man. Appreciate it.
It's great to be with you, Nathan.
I love it. We are, if you're listening to this one and you haven't listened to the previous one with Jim, you need to stop what you're doing, hit pause, go back and listen to that one, because we're going to pick up our conversation and kind of riff off of what we were talking about previously. So y'all do that, but very quickly, as by way of introduction, Jim is what is known as a neurotheologian. He is right outside of Denver, Colorado, but has had a long clinical practice as a psychologist, also has his master's degree in theology, and then also has just been in this conversation for a long time. And so we're blessed to have his ideas, his expertise, and also, frankly, his experience in helping people really move toward a more, you know, full-brained, so to speak, Christianity. So, Jim, we left off the last conversation just talking more about like the integration of these things. I know we talked about like left brain Christianity, right brain Christianity. Why don't you just summarize what has been the dominant theory of change for the church around the left brain first, and then we'll kind of move toward a more full picture of it.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that you would use the word dominant there, because this left and right brain is sort of stereotyped. I mean, the two brain sides of the brain work together, but the left brain is dominant for some things, and the right brain is dominant for others. And so it's not just that side of the brain, but it's to keep people from thinking we don't know about that, I thought we should mention
thank you for doing that. And a really good book on that is by Ian McGilchrist, called The Master and His Emissary. So I know there is kind of this popular level, I'm a left brain person, I'm a right brain person. We're not talking about that. That's not right. What I mean by left brain dominant is the idea that we've adopted that really is from the Enlightenment and other things, that goes, hey, if I can just get you rational, if I can activate your rational thinking around certain ideas, then that is enough to change you. And that's what I mean by left brain dominant.
Antonio Damasio wrote the book Descartes' Error, which is about that. If people like it's fairly readable, actually, for brain scientists. You know, always remarkable when a scientist can write something that you can read.
But, I know, right? But there's a handful of them out there, How God Changes the Brain. And I know Kurt Thompson's done some stuff around this. Yeah. And yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. And so we've got the brain running at different speeds is what we're talking about here. And the left side of the brain runs primarily at conscious speed. And the signals tend to go from the front of the brain to the back. And so we've kind of looked at the world through our conscious mind for as long as people have been around. And we realize there's something else going on that we're not completely conscious about. And so different words have been made up for it, like unconscious or subconscious, right, or right, preconscious.
Implicit explicit, implicit, yeah.
All that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's mostly dominant on the right side of the brain that actually goes from the back to the front. So it processes things in a different order. You might say that the right side of the brain primarily puts a picture together of who I am right now. And the left side of the brain says, how did it get that way? And it takes that picture and takes it apart into its ingredients and gives it words and descriptions and processes and say, well, this is how it happens. As Ian McGilchrist pointed out, the right side of the brain has to take everything into account. The left side of the brain gets over-focused on details.
Yeah, it's granular. Down in the weeds.
And so theology has tended to land on the left side of the brain and the conscious process. Here's what we can be aware of. But the right side of the brain actually runs faster than the left side of the brain because it's got to figure out in a continuous way, who am I right now? So the left side of the brain thinks we always know, but the right side of the brain goes, no, I'm in a new situation. I'm not sure who I am right now.
Yeah, the right side's constantly reminding the left side that it doesn't know what it's talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But rather than being unconscious, it's faster than conscious. So yeah. I've used the word supraconscious. It's running faster than conscious thought, figuring out who I am and what is it like me to do and how do I react. And that's where our identity is in this particular side. So since the most of the Western thought and most human thought has focused on the conscious side, here's what I can be conscious of, we can never quite catch up with this other part of our brain that's doing something else. But what if God's talking to both sides of the brain? He's talking to the side of your brain that's saying, here's who you really are, and here's who you're supposed to be. Because, you know, the right side of the brain knows I should be more than I am right now. It's always looking, it's wired to look for a greater mind than mine. So who can show me how to act like myself? What should I do in this circumstances? And all of us run into circumstances, even as adults, that we're going like, now what am I supposed to do? And we know we're supposed to do something, you know, but we just don't know what.
Yeah, there's kind of this instinctual, like, go where?
Yeah. You know, my wife here is a sort of tragic story, but about 2 years ago, my wife developed leukemia and died. And I remember being in the room with the rest of the family as she was dying and looking around at my grandchildren and everybody else going, you know, this is a really important moment in life and I really should be doing something, but I've never lived through this before. And I really don't know who to be or how to be that, but I know I should do something and I should be something. And it's not repeatable. It's, you know, this is a very important moment. And we all get into those situations in life where we know this is the stuff that life is made of, but I'm not really quite sure how I'm supposed to be under these conditions, but I know I should be something. That's your right brain trying to figure this out. And that's when we really need God's input, you know, like, well, this is what I created you to be, son. And so, but that happens faster than conscious thought. So the problem is all those things that we read about, which would go in the left side of the brain. And Christianity, in most of our English speaking, the translations have been post-Enlightenment. So they've had the Enlightenment influences in there. So even like the Ten Commandments, the Hebrew word that we translate as a commandment could just as well have been the Ten Descriptions. So here's the 10 ways in which my people act. This is what you're like. Or these are the 10 things God told you to do. They're alternate ways of translating the same text. So what if it's the 10 descriptions of what God's people are like? We think of that very differently than commandments on the left side of our brain. The right side of our brain goes, oh, that's who I am? You know, oh, so, hey, if I knew who I was, goodness, I wouldn't bear false witness, you know, I'd be, yeah, that's what I'm created to be. And somehow when we discover that, it goes like, wow, that feels profound.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Well, and there's also like community, when the community is given descriptions of what it is, then the community can elevate those values, hold one another accountable. You know, when there's a deviant artifact, it's like, whoa, hang on, come back, you know, as opposed to, well, you shouldn't have done that. You know, like the thus saith the Lord just has a different feel to it.
Yeah, and so Dallas Willard used it as a loving your enemies as the benchmark for spiritual maturity. Not whether you could suppress your not liking them and trying to make yourself, but whether you spontaneously responded to them as, wow, I care about you. I share life with you. I want to be connected with you in some way. I once wanted to write a book called Tethered to Trouble, you know, because tethered is a good way for attached. And probably all of us have had some relative that we're tethered to that was like, oh, I'd rather not be connected to this relative. But there's some kind of connection that says, yeah, but he's still your dad, or he's still your uncle, or he's still your grandfather, or he's still your, you know.
Whoever it is, yeah.
Yeah, whoever it is, yeah. I remember one of my relatives saying about his mother, She lived to have a very, very long life because she was so wicked, not even the devil wanted to take her.
That's jacked. All right, man. Tell me how you really feel.
Yeah, yeah. You're just as sincere as the day is long about it. It's like, you know, that was my mother. You know, it's like I'm tethered to this thing. I'm connected to it. I can't get rid of it. That's attachment. So how do we form that response to our enemies as our first reaction, as opposed to like, well, I really don't like them, but I'm going to try to treat you nicely and all of that, which is the left hemisphere trying to come up with a procedure. And the problem is that when we come up with the procedures like commands, as instead of characteristics, commands are like, how do I make myself do that? Characteristics are, how do I find that part of myself that's like Jesus and would respond this way? And who's going to help me do it? It's the problem is for the brain, other people can't reveal to you how you are more than any they know you are. So you need God to reveal that. But with your brain, it doesn't get enough practice unless it works it out with other people. So we have this, we need some voice in our mind greater than any other human. But at the same time, in order for that to become reality, we have to practice it with other people. So where is this practice team? You know, the primary thoughts then are, well, in Christianity, one is it's never going to change. And so we just participate in the Christian rituals each week. And we wait for the time to run out because it won't actually change.
Yep. Well, I think that's what Willard said, right? Is he was like most pastors or church leaders are weekly trying to get people to do something that they don't really want to do. Mm-hmm. Right. And you're like, yeah, that rings true a lot. It's interesting too, Jim, because I'm thinking about our training institutions, right? The people who are training the pastors. I mean, I'm thinking about Bible colleges, seminaries, stuff like that. You get heavy, and a lot of the tail's wagging the dog in a lot of ways because you have accreditation institutions who are required, like this, the seminary or Bible college required to do certain things. But we've adopted a pedagogy that is very more information, less relational training. I mean,
it's all conscious track.
Yeah, exactly right. Stuff. And so when you ask, it's like, well, where is the relational training? I mean, I didn't want to interrupt you in the moment, but my initial thought was, it's not in the seminaries. I know it's not. I've been in three of them, you know, it's not there. And again, I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm not trying to be pejorative or look at them in any kind of judgmental way. I get it. It's hard. Given the way that everything is set up. And yet that doesn't change the fact that we have to be relationally trained. And so how have you seen relational training get integrated into this in a way that does address that whole, the firewall of, you know, attachment and relationships in the process of spiritual formation?
Well, in one way that church hasn't really been working on it in a while, so it's harder to find examples of that sort of thing. You know, one of the things in the American church was that in World War II, you know, the chaplain was actually believed to be, you know, the seminaries were teaching people to deal with the problems of real life. But in the Vietnam War, one of the ways you could get out of going to Vietnam was to go to seminary. It was about the only way to do that. And a lot of people took the seminary track, not because they were feeling quite so strongly called to it as they were feeling called away from Vietnam. And they wanted to professionalize the clergy. So the answer of how do you actually do the relational part became in seminaries, how do you become a professional, not how do you become connected or attached to everybody. And, you know, professional means we're all interchangeable. So you can swap one dentist for the next, your dentist can drop dead, the next dentist can step in and do exactly the same procedure. So it's all procedural and you don't form relationships. And most seminaries begin to teach that you don't form relationships with your congregants because that ruins your professional image and relationship.
And also they'll fire you. How many pastors, right? I mean, there are a bunch of them are listening to this right now. How many of you guys are like, man, if my congregation really knew me, then I would. And most of the time, that's not good, you know, which is super tragic.
That produces a really first-rate firewall. Yeah, got no attachments, got no connections. No one gets past the firewall. But it also produces a Christianity that doesn't get past firewalls because you're not going to equip all your congregants how to get through firewalls if you don't want anybody to do it to you. So it's also sort of non-transformative for the pastors. So all of these things have sort of conspired with each other, you might say. And then from the other side, we have to just bring the Holy Spirit in and wash it all out and get rid of, all of that human part of you that's getting in the way and let some power of God come through. Because they could see, you know, there isn't a whole lot of power to transform lives that's going on with all these people that got their beliefs right. So let's just let God straight in. And the problem there again is, how do you practice with other people if you're just trying to get rid of yourself? And so it forms another kind of a barrier. And those have been the primary theories that churches have, get rid of yourself, get all the right beliefs, or it's never going to change and just, you know, do the Christian thing for the rest of your life. And, in the next life, you'll be able to be a Christian.
But I'm hearing you talk about, you said something in our previous conversation that's sticking on me, that if our brain, the actual gray matter in our skull, is the hardware, then, you know, our mind or our identity or the me is the software. And you said in our previous conversation, yeah, the crazy thing is the software can change the hardware. And so I'm hearing you talk about the reality that there is another way, and that way requires getting into the hardware and rewiring it. But that, what does that process look like practically? Like, what's the training that has to happen in order for people's hardwiring to change?
Well, that actually is a kind of the question we were asking that started the Renovated Book Project, and something that was back around 2012, 2013, right at sort of the end of Dallas's life. And it was about the time you were getting into the field from a conversation we had off record here. But Dallas was going to a church on one side of the street, and on the other side of the street was where a counseling center was. And so he was getting people to experience the spiritual disciplines. And, about three quarters of the time, could really make the spiritual disciplines have a profound effect on their lives. And about another quarter of the people, and for even the people who had worked about a quarter of the time, it was like spiritual disciplines are not working too well. And Dallas himself said there's no spiritual value in the spiritual disciplines. The spiritual value is in the room they create and the things they set up. So these are all procedural. This is the left brain slow track. Procedures can be very, very, very helpful in allowing something to happen if the right ingredients are there.
They can set up an environment and put the ingredients there, but spiritual disciplines in and of themselves can never actually change somebody. That has to be a relational reality between you and God. Yep. And
we weren't so sure about the relational part of it at that part of the discussion, because the relational brain was still kind of new to everybody at that point. The first book on the subject that was really established, it was about 2003. So the brain is pretty new ingredient, and there was relational was. We knew some things about the brain, but not about the relational part. So we realized that the people that were having trouble were the people who had not formed good relationships. Their basic attachment part of the brain was so scrambled that how relationships work made no sense to them, you know. And people, you know, say, well, okay, that's what's that got to do with Christianity? Well, you know, I have yet to met a Christian who, by virtue of believing in Jesus, suddenly became fluent in Hebrew and Greek.
yep.
They had to learn how Hebrew and Greek worked by virtue of interacting with somebody who knew how it worked. And so even the people who might, you'd say, are scripture-only sort of Christians, they had to learn from a person how to understand that scripture. Right. Well, relationships are actually more complicated than Hebrew and Greek. And you have to learn from a brain that knows how to do relationships, how to make sense of them. And that most of that happens in the first 2 years of life. In fact, most of the song and dance is over by the time you're 9 months old. That's what your brain is incorporating. How does the brain around me work? We used to have people come to our center who their parents were in one of their parents was in Atascadero, the prison for the criminally insane. So they had copied a criminally insane brain. You know, if some of you ever saw Young Frankenstein, you know, the Abby Normal brain that they put in, in Frankenstein's monster.
Into the monster, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you copied a brain that's criminally insane or otherwise really bad, when you can't make sense of how God thinks, because you think this is how other brains think, you know. So you have to form an attachment with somebody who's full of joy instead of full of fear, full of, you know, I can see who God is growing in you, as opposed to I'm going to turn you into my servant or slave or, you know, person to please me or, you know, person I hate or whatever else.
Something to be used. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to learn this pattern from another brain that knows how to do it. That's how God designed the process, you know. And so you copy from where are you going to get these other brains that actually look at you right? Well, you have to be in a community. And this is what we discovered. The communities, the people who are doing well, had people in their life almost always through church. And almost 100% not organized by the church. So this wasn't a church program. It would just happen to be people they met in church that said, you know, well, you'll be like a son to me, or you'll be like a sister to me, or you'll be like a, you know.
Yeah, they're just organically doing the human thing. Like, I see you, I'm with you, without being taught. It's like, it's almost like it's hardwired in us.
Yes, almost like that. Yeah,
it's almost like that.
But not as part of a church program, but it happened at church. These were people who were looking at others and saying, I want to find out what God is doing in your life, and I want to be a part of it. And that's the setup. But those are the people that are actually getting some transformation, and they could get the spiritual disciplines to work for them more and increasingly, because now it's like, okay, spiritual disciplines, let me get all this other activity out of my way and kind of learn from God in this quiet kind of way. You know, he's not so noisy. He's not so, you know, he doesn't impose himself in me like all these crazy people do. And so this is where we begin to say, okay, this is how it works. So the people who have got pretty good relationship skills, let life crowd God out of it. So spiritual disciplines make room for God to get back in there and talk to you. The people who haven't learned how to even organize their life at all enough to know how relationships work need some people that will practice relationships with them so that they can begin to realize God doesn't think like everybody else does. And everybody has some degree of both tensions, right? But you need both ingredients in order to be able to say, oh, well, God says I'm different. These other people can see that in me. They let me practice. And by the way, when we're practicing, we're not good at things.
Right? Yeah, seriously. Yeah. You got to practice all the time, you're not a master of it yet. Yeah.
A lot of grace is needed and a lot of long suffering. You know, Jesus would say, the word we translate long suffering is the one that's also translated when Jesus says, how long do I have to put up with you? You know, we have to put up with each other a lot in order to begin to make room for this kind of thing. And to me, that's what, you know, we discovered the church needed. It needed disciplines, but it also needed the relationship. And the disciplines worked well for people who already had relationship. But for the people who didn't have relationship, they needed a relationship first before the disciplines made any difference at all.
Yeah. So for our audience who's sitting here going, yeah, I'm like resonating with what you're saying, But I also maybe go to a church where like relationships are very superficial, or everybody's putting on a certain facade to try to make sure everybody thinks that they're good. There's not very much, there's not a whole lot of vulnerability, or yeah, people are just not showing up in any kind of real authentic way. What do you tell them? Because that's a lot of people, right? I mean, that's, I can't, you know, qualify this, but I would say that probably more than half, in my experience anyway, of people are like, man, how do I do that? If it's not programmatized, if it's not something that's like, hey, come to this thing and do that, like, what would you tell that person right now?
Well, one thing I'd tell you for sure is you have a whole lot of company. The other book you mentioned, The Other Half of Church, went right to the top of the most podcasts and most engagement of any book that Moody had published up until that point.
And isn't that crazy,
people,
man,
are just saying, yeah, I've got to hear about this. How do you actually develop a environment for the church in which relationships can prosper? And the first thing you have to say is, well, we actually have to start building joy. How do we allow people to discover each other and be glad to be together? But then you also have to build in a corrective for joy. Like, if we just let it run, what'll end up happening is the parts of me that have never, I've never allowed in public, mm-hmm. Will come out and meet the parts of you that you shouldn't have allowed in public either.
And, yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden you have, you know, what happens in a lot of small groups after 2 years, everybody's dirty laundry comes out, and, you find out that, you know, you like the dirty laundry of that person better than the one you're married to. And, you have to have somehow God speaking into this. And so how do we learn to be quiet and hear God's voice? Hearing God's voice has become controversial, at least in the American church. The only way you can hear God's voice for some people is through scripture. The only way you can hear God's voice for other people is through some kind of worship experience or through some kind of vision. But all of these become sort of lack of relational content that works if I'm talking to you. So, how do you actually hear God's voice when I'm in a relationship with other persons? That, recognize it. Here's the thing. I think God speaks to everybody, but most of the time the brain doesn't recognize the voice. And it just seems, there was a weird thought went through my head.
Because we're not trained to, listen for that voice. And which is super interesting, right? Because Jesus is like, my sheep hear my voice and they know me, right? So there is this sense of like, no, you definitely can hear the voice of God, but also you have to be conditioned through practices, through, to go, hey, it's that one and not that one, you know?
Yeah. Well, here's the interesting thing. When we say voice, we always are drawn towards the left hemisphere conscious, very, very slow voice that we recognize as someone talking in words. But in our identity center, which is where we need to hear the voice of God, it runs faster. It runs through a whole loop in a sixth of a second. And conscious mind takes a fifth of a second. And so God is giving us a thought, but it comes in through the mutual mind center. So when we're doing mutual mind kind of thinking with God, that is happening so fast that we can't consciously recognize, was that my thought or God's thought? We would have to slow it down considerably to even figure that out. But that's one thing spiritual disciplines let you do. They slow down some of these thoughts long enough that you can observe them.
Yep.
But
well, and you end up seeing with anybody, just like knowing the voice of your spouse or your parent or your friend or whatever. After a while, it's like, hey, it becomes an intuitive thing that you've developed over time to go, yeah, I recognize that. When it does show up, there's that check in my spirit that, my conscious slow processing can't necessarily keep up with, unless there's been so much training, so to speak, in that area that you just naturally recognize it, and it causes you to go, hang on. I need to pay attention to that.
Yes, and that's what we need practice doing. And every human brain is capable of fooling itself occasionally, and so we need some corporate listening to it. Narcissists in particular really like their own thoughts so well that they're able to attribute them to God on an ongoing sort of basis and fool themselves and the people around them. But, you know, if we practice that with other people, it doesn't bring this shalom, this peace, you know, let the peace of God be the arbiter or the referee or the judging, the thing for all your experience. It's like, yeah, that is exactly how God would think about it. And God's objective is to have us think the same way. That's what we're actually aiming for. So when a thought comes from God to someone who loves God, it's going to be almost indistinguishable from your own thought. That's actually the goal, you know, but usually we're looking for what Jane Willard used to call God's cathedral voice.
Yeah.
Now hear this, my son. You know,
it echoes lower, cosmic thing. Yeah.
Where the good way to translate, you know, that still small voice that Elijah the prophet heard
in 1 Kings 19, the word
can also be translated silence. So it's almost a silence, but it's a knowing that we're looking for. And so this is what Christianity needs to teach us to do. Spiritual disciplines help with that. But in the relational space, we also need people who think that way with us so that we can experience that when we're actually looking at somebody. I like to call it sharing your face with Jesus. So my friend Ed Corey wrote a book called Becoming a Face of Grace, in which he talks of basically how do you create the kind of relationships in the church in which Jesus is regularly sharing your face and your voice tone and real-time interactions so that he's actually living through you in a way that actually, instead of getting rid of you, enhances who he
meant
you to
totally.
Be.
Yeah, you're becoming more fully human. Yeah. I loved what, I think it was Willard who said this, but I love the idea that defining spiritual maturity as getting to the point in your walk with Christ where you can do whatever you want. And I think what he meant by that was like your will and his will are so aligned that trying to go, okay, you know, where do I stop and he begins and what's my voice and his voice, but it's so integrated that you're like, it becomes easy, to walk in step with the Spirit, which frankly is what Jesus was doing. I mean, I tell people all the time, I'm like, man, you know what would have been really hard for Jesus? Not that it wasn't like, not that he wasn't tempted or that it wasn't a trial, but it would have been exceedingly difficult for Jesus to have not obeyed his Father. Like he'd never done it before, you know? And so it's like he, being in fellowship with his Father was easy for him. Like, and so when, to the point where the Father's like, yeah, we're going to do this. You're going to go to the cross. And he's like, really? Isn't there another way? But at the end of the day, I trust you, you know. And
well, he described it as just doing what he saw his Father doing. And the problem we have is we don't see what the Father is doing. You know, we don't have the attachment to do that with him. But that is a much faster process. That's that right hemisphere process where you see what someone else is doing and you just join in with them on that. It runs much faster than words. You know, you can use words to describe it, but, you know.
But Paul's getting at that, right, in Ephesians 3, where he's like, hey, my prayer for you is that you would have the power, you being rooted and established, right, in love, in hesed, would have power together with all of God's people. Again, there's the communal aspect of it, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of the Messiah, and that you would know that love that surpasses knowledge, which is kind of like, how do you know something that surpasses your ability to know, you know? And
I kind of look at that. The closest I get to that is, you know, I look up at the stars and think about counting them. You know, it's like, well, I know how to count. I know, but this is like more than I can take in. This is huge.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And so,
But it's an experience, right? You're not sitting there going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Instead, you're taking in this experience that surpasses your capacity to put words on it or to, you know, wax eloquent on it, right?
And since Dallas also had that view of us as we are infinitely bigger than we know, you know, it's like being yourself makes total sense if you understand yourself to be who you're going to be 500 years from now, which is how I often tell people, like, you know, like all of these little quirks that are badly trained brain, they're not going to be with you in 500 years. So who will you be then? And be that person freely now as much as you can be. Let's live into that. Let's, you know, this post-resurrection self. We're trying to see. Paul says it's hard to see. It's, you know, it's sort of like a through a dark glass, and it, you know, we vaguely understand. But let's lean into that as a community, and freely be that self. Which, by the way, will be very hard for us to predict. Jesus says it's like the wind. You see the wind, you know where it's blowing, but you don't know exactly what it's up to, where it's going. And we are those kind of creatures as well. You know, we're who God sees us as being, if we're going about his business, is always driving a little ahead of our brain's headlights, because our brain knows very well who we were in the past, but it has no idea who we're going to be in the future. Unless we just predict that the past will continue.
Right.
And all of us don't want that to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So. That's going to be a really dangerous thing. But John gets at this in 1 John 3, where he says, hey, brothers and sisters, like, we don't yet know what we're going to become. But we know that when he appears, when Christ appears, we will be like him, right? Because we'll see him as he is. And that gets at that, you know, what's fundamental to the work that I've done around God image is that so many people, you know, because of those relational, those broken relational patterns with insecure attachment figures, the firewall is really strong, right?
Right.
The information is hitting it.
Yeah,
they totally are. But even for all of us who are in Christ, when we see him, all of those things are going to get obliterated, right? Because we're going to see him as he is. And that, I mean, I guess as we close this time, as we close this episode, I mean, I think it's good for our, you know, for the audience to, for you guys to just consider, like, man, what kind of being is that? That when he shows up and you see him, that it just destroys all of the malformation and the parts of us that are, you know, that are broken, and we are changed to be like him. I'm just like, again, I'm like, who is that? Like, I'm excited to see. I'm excited to see. So any closing thoughts for you?
What I would add to that is that we want to lean into that now, because God is revealing to us in glory to glory kind of ways who he's seeing in each one of us. And as we're looking for that, you know, when Paul tells Titus, teach the older women not to be devils or accusers, it's like there's a tendency among human beings to look at each other as who you really are is all the broken parts. And although we used to say, see Jesus according to the flesh, we do so no longer, Peter teaches us. We got to do that with each other, saying, well, yeah, I know how broken you know how to be, and your brain has learned all of that real well, but that's not who you're becoming, and I'm going to be an ally to that. I'm going to lean into what God is doing, do what he's doing, see what he's seeing, speak what he's doing in you, and help you and encourage you to become that person, that new creation. You know, the reemergence of Eden.
Yeah,
in who God meant us to be.
Amen, brother. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your time, man. This has been a fun conversation. As to talk about joy, I have been glad to be with you. And hopefully our audience feels the same. Hey guys, if y'all are interested, if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, every single week we have our Eden chapters around the DFW Metroplex. And one of them is in the Fort Worth area out in Aledo and White Settlement. And then there's one that meets here in Dallas. You can email us at info@edenteam.org. That's info@edenteam.org. But we are every single week, we're here with people doing the relational training that Jim and I have been talking about. So I would encourage you guys to do that. If you have questions or anything about this stuff, or if you want to learn more about Jim's ministry and the resources that he has, please email us at podcast@edenteam.org. And man, as we learn more and more about the beauty and the complexity and the just majesty of how God has created us and made us and who we are, we just hope that this resource, God in the Brain, helps you more deeply move into the reality of who you are and how loved you are by a God who is love.
You've been listening to God in the Brain. If you like what you heard, subscribe, tell your friends, give us a rating. If you have questions, email us at podcast@edenteam.org. If you want to know more about our organization, visit our website at theedenproject.com. Lastly, check out our other podcasts. Thanks for joining us, and remember, God loves you. Bye.
Peace.